Good morning. I will call the Civil Law and Data Practices Committee to order. Representative Pugh, you had a moment to look at the minutes from Tuesday.
I have, Madam Chair, and I move the minutes for February the 21st.
Any discussion on the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of approval, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Minutes are adopted. First order of business this morning, Representative Zerwas, House File 1281. Welcome to the committee. And I will.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Good morning, members of the committee.
Good morning. I will move House File 1281 that it be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Security Policy and Finance. Representative Zerwas, do you have an amendment?
Yeah, Madam Chair. There is an author's amendment that was passed down by nonpartisan staff as a grammatical fix. So if we could adopt the A1, that would be great.
Fantastic. Discussion on the A1. Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. A1 is adopted. To your bill, Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, members, House File 1281 is similar to a bill I've carried in the past dealing with pre-judgment interest. In 2009, the legislature changed the interest rate all the way up to 10%, a dramatic increase to what it had been previously. And then a year later, in 2010, counties, and townships came to the legislature and asked for relief. Cities, counties, and townships explained that a 10% prejudgment interest rate is too burdensome and too expensive, and it wasn't something that should be hoisted upon the government. In recognition of the burden of that 10% interest rate, the legislature responded and lowered the interest rate for government and prejudgment issues to a 4% interest rate, but left the interest rate at 10% for private parties. The 10% interest rate is extremely burdensome. It's extremely expensive, and in some instances, in a post-judgment situation, can actually, or pre-judgment situation, can actually encourage that litigation could be drawn out because a potential awardee is getting a 10% return on their interest rate. In recent years, across the country, recognizing the historically low interest rates that we've been experiencing, 34 states have responded and lowered their interest rates below 10%. And so Minnesota has not acted except to the benefit of government. And so we're here asking that we treat private parties with the same consideration as we treat government. And with that, Madam Chair, I do have a testifier on this bill who can add some additional information.
Very fine. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota, but I'm here testifying on behalf of Minnesotans for Lawsuit Reform, which I know you've seen the roster. It's an organization of over 65,000 Minnesota employers in the state that's in support of Representative Zerwas's bill. Minnesota, like the rest of the country, committee members, has recognized the time value of money in the civil justice system in the form of these pre-judgment interest rate laws. And so as all states have these, it's a pre-judgment, post-judgment. This bill deals with the pre-judgment. And so recognizing the time value of money, it's really an interest rate that's put into the statutes. So if somebody's recovering money for damages and it takes some time for the system to process it, then an interest value is added to that. And so really, as this morning, I really see there's only really one question before the committee. It's actually a pretty simple question. What should be that time value of money that we write into our statute? And that statute is that 549.09, as it's in the bill. And the three numbers that I'll ask you to think about, and Representative Zerwas has indicated them, is the first one is 0.84%, and then 4% and 10%. 0.84, 4%, and 10%. 0.84 is that one-year Treasury bill rate. So you can look that up. It's published annually. The statute references the calculation for the state court administrator to do. And the key thing is it. That's what's written into this statute. In other words, so this time value of money in our civil justice system, the way you, the legislature, have expressed it and put the calculation is the one-year Treasury bill rate. So the calculation's in law. But then the legislature has gone on to specify, and it's changed over time, a dollar amount, despite that calculation, that's not going to go below. A dollar amount that it's not going to go below. So, and you can pull up and look at it, what that one-year T-bill rate has been over the last 10 years, surely over the last 5 years, 6 years. It's 0.84 now. A year ago it was 0.54. So the key thing is that is the measurement of what's the time value of money. So this statute is not intended to be, it's not written in terms of what's a credit card interest rate. It doesn't reference the state's usury laws, bank laws. There's a number of indices that could have been put into law. Well, they're not in the law. It's the one-year T-bill rate. So that's the key measurement, and that's the way you see this around the country. And you have the chart in front of you. Representative Zerwas went through the history. It was in 2009 that this legislature, in a public safety budget bill, made the changes that you have before you in today's law. In other words, it was 10%, which was written into the law, and then a year later, in 2010, and the governmental units of Minnesota came to the legislature and said, as Representative Zerwas indicated, this is costing government a lot of money. And so the 10% was lowered to 4% for units of government, and the private sector kept at the 10%. So really, Madam Chair and committee members, it's a simple question. And for us, within Minnesotans for Lawsuit Reform, the 10% is simply out of touch with reality. Where in this country or world do you get a guaranteed 10% rate of return on money? Where do you get a guaranteed 10% rate of return on money? Just out of sync with the time value of money. The differentiation between the public and the private is just unfair. 4% is the right measurement. And that's our state policy in Minnesota since 2010 for all units of government. So why do we keep the private sector at 10? And so for us, Madam Chair and committee members, and Representative Zerwas went through just a little bit of the history. The last 2 points is that you have the chart in front of you that you can get an indication of what are other states doing. So at least it's relevant in where we sit today. 34 states are below 10. 11 are at 10 or above, so we've got the states listed there. And what the trends or the movements are is that it's not going up. What states are acting, they're moving them down. Why are they moving them down? Because of the interest rate market. That's why they're moving them down. They're moving them down because this statute is not supposed to be what it costs an individual via their credit cards if they have to use them. It's not mortgage rates. You could have, as the legislature, specified whatever you wanted in terms of that index, and what you specified is the one-year T-bill rate, you know, with the clauses then that it put some floors in. So frankly, it's what we count is about 25 states in the last 3 years have lowered their prejudgment interest rate. And there's states that go, I didn't put on that chart, you have the current ones, and I won't go through it, but we could go through it and indicate to you the changes. Idaho moved their interest rate from 12% to 5.25. Colorado moved theirs from 9% to 2%. New Jersey moved theirs from 4% to 0.5. So this chart doesn't actually show you all of the downward movement. That is what's going on around the country, Madam Chair and committee members. So we believe that this is a reasonable bill. It brings consistency across everybody who is subjected, who actually has to pay the prejudgment interest. So it deals with the inequity that we have today. It gets it closer. We understand the notion of a floor, and so we're not arguing today with the 4%. As you can see, other states have moved it even lower. We've got states that have gone, Oklahoma went to 0.25%, New Jersey went to 0.5%. And so, Madam Chair and committee members, that's the case for this. I did want to indicate that one of our witnesses would have been Gino Fragnito from the Minnesota Society of CPAs. He would have been testifying. He had to go to a board meeting this morning. So the Minnesota Society of CPAs are strongly in support of this and would have addressed some of the market interest rate issues had there been questions about that. So in conclusion, just on behalf of the 65,000-plus employers in this state under the umbrella of the Minnesotans for Lawsuit Reform, we urge you to support Representative Zerwas's bill, House File 1281. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. What I'd like to do, members, is go through all the testimony, and then we'll open up to member questions. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Next, I have John Tushesher. So, Tushesher. Is that right?
Tushesher. Close enough.
It's way easier than it looks. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair, Joel Carlson, I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice, and Mr. Tetcher, who's our legislative chair for our association, is going to talk a little bit about how this works in practice. But I just wanted to give you just a brief little bit of background, because we like to come here and talk about lawsuit abuse, but we never really talk about what's actually going on in Minnesota courts. And I want to talk, I want to just give you some information about that, and I think it will be surprising to you. So the Minnesota Supreme Court tracks case filings in Minnesota. And in 2016, there were 2,620 personal injury cases filed in Minnesota. That is a decline of 33% over the last 10 years. And of that amount, 125 cases were tried to a verdict by a jury in Minnesota out of a state with 5.5 million people. Do we have lawsuit abuse in Minnesota? I don't think so. And to look at how Minnesota compares nationally, the Center for State Courts just released a report last week about how Minnesota stacks up, and we've got injury cases and we have contract cases. Contract cases are generally cases that are filed among businesses over their disputes. We had over 8,000 contract cases. That list of people on the lawsuit reform group filed almost three times more cases than consumers in our civil cases, in our civil courts. And the Center for National Courts said Minnesota has the lowest number of cases per capita filed on contract cases in the country, about 500 cases per every 100,000 in population. The highest, over 16,000 cases filed in Maryland per 1,000 population. We do not have any litigation, explosion, or abuse in Minnesota. So it just isn't true that this interest rate is extending litigation or causing litigation in Minnesota. And what I really think is true is the opposite, because you need to understand what post-judgment interest is there for. Post-judgment interest has three purposes. Number one, it's to compensate you for the loss of use of your money that's been wrongly taken from you from someone else. This isn't a savings rate. This isn't what you would get if you kept it underneath your mattress or you got it at it and put it in a passbook savings account. This is to compensate you for the interest rate that you've had to pay while someone else has wrongfully owed you money. And you're not getting that money at 0.5%. You're not getting that at 4%. This is a borrowing rate. This is not a savings rate. And when I looked at bankrate.com, what's the lowest credit card I could get? I looked it up last night. 11.5%. That's their low rates. And that's what you have to pay while this case is pending. It's not 0.5%. or 4%, it's well in excess of that. And after that judgment is entered, that interest on those medical bills that aren't paid continues to accrue. And I don't know what's in your wallet, but I'm not borrowing money at 4%. That's what this interest rate does. And we saw in 2009 that people were needlessly delaying cases because of our low interest rate, and that your constituents were not getting justice promptly because there was an incentive to not pay. That's why the law was changed. And secondly, the second purpose is to promote that prompt payment. And that's happening in Minnesota. So compensate you for the loss of use of your money, promote prompt payment. And lastly, post-judgment interest is designed to prevent frivolous appeals because your costs are ongoing. What's happened since this law changed? Civil appeals are down 28% since this law was changed. It's had a change in behavior. And I want to point out one point that was raised about the change as it relates to government, because I was actively involved in that. The biggest expense for government as it relates to judgments has to do with their property tax appeals. This has nothing to do with injury cases. And they came to us and said, we don't calculate that on these property tax appeals that can be millions of dollars for high-value property in places like downtown Minneapolis, where they have a property tax appeal where they have to make a rebate to a property taxpayer, sometimes in the millions of dollars. And we agreed that that is something that should change. And don't think that governments aren't treated differently. If you think they are treated the same in civil court, you have to look at Chapter 466 and look at all the immunities and protection that governments have. They are not treated in court the same right now. And I'd love to do something about that, but that's not the issue before us. They are absolutely treated differently by this legislature. You know, and the last thing, and we've seemed to have missed it, but if you look at the bill, on lines 3.27 and 3.28, you'll see a curious little provision. And it says this doesn't apply to a case under 68.0811. Those are cases, business cases, contract cases, insurance cases among businesses. That interest rate gets to stay at 10%. That's what it's set at statutorily. And by this very provision in law, in Representative Zerwas's bill, you will see that this 4% rate doesn't apply to business. It only applies to your consumers. Madam Chairman, this bill was vetoed by Governor Dayton in 2012, and I don't think anything has changed since. In fact, I think it's gotten more important that we keep this law in place because we do not have the kind of litigation that other states have, and I think this is one of the reasons why. So we would urge caution and urge you to really consider what's going on in court, the case files that we have, the low amount of litigation that Minnesota has. And that's, I think, because of some of the laws that we have in place that you've wisely put in place. Thank you, Madam Chairman. Have Mr. Tetcher give his testimony, and then we're happy to answer questions.
Mr. Tetcher, please state your name for the record and go on with your testimony.
Certainly. Thank you, Madam Chairperson. My name is Josh Tetcher. I'm an attorney in Minneapolis. I practice at Meshbesher and Spence. I want to talk about the practical implications of the rule change. Before 2009, when this rule change came in, to effect, what you would see is delay tactics in payment of claims. And so what individual, your voters in your communities would have to do is to burn through savings accounts, put medical bills on credit cards, because the meter is still running. The meter is still running on all of the medical bills and those outstanding payments that individual consumers in Minnesota have after a date of loss, after the accident. And so after 2009, the practice really on behalf of the insurance industry in this state changed somewhat when they started to recognize the impact of delaying. And we're talking about time value of money here. They recognized that it was less beneficial from a financial standpoint to delay payment of a verdict or an award. And so justice was done, so that the verdict was paid, the award was paid. So there was a real practice change after 2009, making sure that claims were actually resolved. What we saw was that claims were settled on a more timely basis afterwards. It was a good benefit of the law. What this particular bill does is roll that back. Rolls it back and then incentivizes delay taxes. It incentivizes appeals. You know, I've been here because I'm the chairperson for our organization to work with the legislature. I've been here and watched this committee over the last couple of weeks. And on Tuesday, you folks entertained changes to Rule 68. And you voted it out of this committee. And the rationale for that vote was that it was going to promote settlement, move cases, promote settlement. This particular bill does the exact opposite. It promotes delay tactics, and it promotes appeals. It's a bad idea, and I don't think it should get out of this committee.
Thank you. Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify on behalf of this bill? Or against? All right. Seeing none, Representative Lesh, I believe you had the first question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, what was the motion on this bill? Was it your intention to lay it over for inclusion in an omnibus bill, or were you, is it your intention to pass this out?
Representative Lesh, this bill is going to Public Safety and Security Policy and Finance Committee.
Mm. Well, Madam Chair, my first question is, and I don't know if it's because I have some questions for you gentlemen, but I'm going to ask what might be a dumb question. Why, when we're talking about post-judgment interest, was a sheet handed out by Minnesotans for Lawsuit Reform detailing pre-judgment interest rates by state? What am I missing?
Madam Chair.
Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, members, unfortunately, we didn't have our amendment ready to meet the 24-hour deadline. If you recall, Representative Lesh, when we had this previously, you and I went round and round in civil law, and we ended up with an amendment to address pre-judgment interest separate from post-judgment interest, to have post-judgment interest remain at 10%, so there would not be an incentive not to pay after the rightful, after a court decision, but to address pre-judgment interest and lower that with the floor at 4%. Unfortunately, that amendment did not meet the 24-hour rule, and we'll have that available for adoption at the next committee. And so that's on me, and I apologize for not having that done in time.
Okay, Madam Chair, Representative Zerwas, so this sheet that was passed out was intended to address an amendment that's not before us, right?
It's... Madam Chair.
Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, members, the prejudgment interest rate by state is to address what the bill will be in its final form, which will be to address prejudgment interest.
Well, Madam Chair,
Representative
Zerwas, this is the committee that should be considering that. I don't know, you know, I abhor the practice of taking an amendment that is the jurisdiction and prerogative of a committee and just saying, well, we don't have it ready, we'll get it on in a different committee whose jurisdiction is, I mean, that's not necessarily their expertise. So I realize sometimes that happens, but Madam Chair, my question related to when the previous testifiers finished, Mr. Carlson, my question that I wrote down what before you spoke was what percentage of suits filed in Minnesota result in actual judgment? And then you came up and the first thing you told was exactly the percentage. 2,620 PI cases were filed. That's down 33%. 125 were tried to verdict. That's 4.7%. So correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Tutcher, but my guess is, and I realize this isn't always the case, but these were cases that resulted in verdicts by wrongdoers as determined by a court. Is that right?
Correct.
Mr. Tetcher.
Okay. Thank you, Lesh. Madam Chair and Mr. Tetcher. So am I wrong to understand that the 4.7% of all cases that this bill seeks to address make life better for the actual wrongdoers, the most egregious wrongdoers who say, forget it, we're not going to settle this thing in good faith, we're going to take it to a jury and see how far we can squeeze this out? Am I right in understanding it that way?
Mr. Tetcher.
Yes.
Okay.
Representative Lesh.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm still trying to wrap my head around this because I don't remember the back and forth that you and I had previously, Representative West. Maybe we did. I don't know. But, yeah, I realize this bill has reared its head.
It's so memorable for me.
I don't remember it. But, you know, there's probably a video somewhere or something, right? I probably should have studied that before I came today. But 4.7% of the baddest actors, we decide, you know what, you guys, you're just having it too tough. We're going to make life a little bit easier on you and bring it down to 4%, which is, as Mr. Carlson correctly stated, not a borrowing rate. You can't get a rate to borrow on that. So maybe you can answer for me, Representative Zerwas, why, when we're reforming something, are we reforming something to give a benefit to the worst actors in the system?
Representative Ross.
Well, Madam Chair and members, what we're doing is we're saying, let's treat private people, private individuals that you represent, that I represent, let's treat them the same way we treat government. We gave government a break. We passed this law in 2009. Government came back and said, this is unfair. We can't pay this. Please, help us. And the state said, you know what, for government, okay, we'll help. For government, 10% is too high, too much, too expensive. I'm saying, how about we treat the people that pay government's bills the same way we treat government?
Well, Madam Chair, I didn't vote for that. As far as I'm concerned, if you're an injured party, you're entitled to your relief regardless of who the tortfeasor is. By the way, I had to use the word tortfeasor today because nobody uses that, and it's a great word. And a friend of mine in law school named their cat tortfeasor. Okay? So it doesn't matter who it is. Why wouldn't we just change it back so that folks who happen to get run over by a garbage truck as opposed to a city bus or something are entitled to the same rate, right? Like if you get run over by a government truck as opposed to a private truck, there's no reason why you shouldn't be entitled to the same rate. And yet you're saying instead of making it more fair for everyone, let's make it less fair for everyone for the purpose of equity.
Representative Ross?
Madam Chair, members, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying let's treat everyone the way we treat government.
Oh.
Representative Lesh.
Madam Chair, I would ask you, Representative Zerwas, you go back to that talking point, and no, this is just an equity issue, and yet the testifiers up here gave some very compelling testimony of why your bill makes no sense for what this should be about, the people who were wronged, the people who were harmed. Do you have anything to say about what this means for justice to people who have to go through life without use of their arm or with a debilitating disease? Do you have anything to say about what this means for them?
Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, members, this bill deals with the ability to set a pre-judgment interest rate, and it deals with setting that rate with some connection to the market and to reality. In statute, that's based off of a set market rate in the Treasury bill. We have departed from that. We recognized the error when it injured government. We corrected that. I'm saying let's follow what 34 other states have done. Let's follow what 25 states have done just in the last 3 years and identify that 10% is too high. And so if we're going to lower it, my suggestion is let's treat private parties the way we treat government.
Oh, Madam Chair, I want to ask another question. Thank you, but I will just make this statement in closing. The reason that happened when it did in 2009, Representative Zerwas, is because government lobbyists flooded these hearing rooms. And let me tell you something. When a bill comes up that government decides affects them in a certain way, government lobbyists show up out of the woodwork. I'm not saying that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it absolutely happens. That's why it happens, because the squeaky wheel gets the grease on around here. They were the squeakiest wheel doing it down in 2009 saying stop all this, and so we stopped it. But just because they were the squeak wheel doesn't mean that that had a great effect for folks who were injured or harmed and had the misfortune of being harmed by a government entity as opposed to a private entity. So I completely disagree with you that somehow this is going to make things more equitable and fair across the board because we want to jump off the bridge with 34 other states. No, this is going to hurt people in the long run. It favors the worst actors in the justice system, and it's a bad bill. And I'll tell you what, I really hope that this thing doesn't make it out of the next committee, but if it does, we'll bring it up on the floor. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Zerwas, you stated that you want to make everybody the same, but line 3.27 specifically excludes these business claims. I have the statute up, 60A.0811. Subdivision 2 deals with the interest, and specifically it has the 10% per annum interest on monetary amounts due under the insurance policy specifically listed in the statute. So why do you believe that your consumers, your voters, don't deserve this protection, but your businesses do deserve 10%? You're not making it fair. That you're claiming you're making it fair, but you're not making it the same for everyone.
Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, there's an exclusion in the bill for our large groups, and that's in there in order to encourage much larger penalties. When we have two big entities fighting, let's not drag that into the court system.
Well, Madam Chair. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what you're saying is, big guy, you can be as wrong as you want to your constituent, or little guy, you don't get the same protection as two big guys fighting. That's what your bill does. You're saying two big guys fight it out as much as you want, but you're going to pay 10%. A big guy who wants to delay in paying your constituent, you get a good deal. They've got to put their bills on their credit card. They got to put out a second mortgage. They might lose their house. They might file bankruptcy, because we know that health care is the number one reason why people file bankruptcy, right? The inability to pay their health care bills. And now if the person did wrong and caused that to happen, they don't even have to make you whole.
Madam Chair.
Representative Zerwas.
That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is let's treat our consumers the way we treat government, and in certain instances, let's look for expediency, as is done in other states. 34 states have made this change, 25 states within the last 3 years. This is the trend that states across the country are responding to the actual market conditions. It's the actual market conditions that states are responding to. You cannot get a 10% return on your money in any location in the market anywhere. We're asking for that to have some connection in the base of reality, which is what our statute asks for. Our statute is grounded to that Treasury bill. So why not have it be at some point related to reality? There could have been in statute something that said, let's have the pre and post judgment interest rates attached to the 15-year to the APR of a Visa credit card. That's not in statute. The Treasury bill is in statute, and it's done that way to have some connection to the financial markets and some connection to reality.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move an oral amendment to delete line 3.27 and 3.28, which is what gives the businesses the protection. And, Madam Chair, I'd ask for a roll call.
Representative Sarah Wass?
Madam Chair, I would oppose that amendment. Madam Chair, if there's no 24-hour rule, I don't know why I...
Representative Hillstrom, could you state that again, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to make an oral amendment to delete line 3.27 and line 3.28 from the bill, and I would ask for a roll call vote.
Representative Hillstrom, that is more than just a technical change to the bill. That significantly changes the bill, and we do have a 24-hour rule for amendments here. So that amendment would be out of order.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, just so the author knows, that amendment will be coming in public safety as well as an amendment to link the statute to the credit card amount, interest rate for consumers, or actual damages that are caused by the victim as well. So those will be the two amendments you'll see in public safety.
Representative Lunin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, first of all, to the author of the bill, I noticed here on line 2.23 that the 4% isn't the number. The 4% is the basement. Would that be correct?
Representative Scott, Representative Lunin, that is accurate. The 4% makes up the floor of the rate.
Representative Lunin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the author of the bill again, what this does is it, every year on an annual basis towards the end of the year, the state court administrator then takes a look at what the interest rate landscape is of the land, and they set what is reasonable in a timely manner. Would that be an accurate statement?
Representative Zerwas.
Correct, Madam Chair. Representative Lunin, the state court administrator would look at the rate and set the rate with the floor being at 4%.
Representative Lunin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there anything in your bill that puts a cap on how high of an interest rate, based on what the landscape is, they're allowed to assign to this provision?
Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, Representative Lunin, no, there is not.
Representative Lunin.
To the testifier, Mr. Carlson, you had, you said the 3 points of the interest awarded on judgment was designed to address loss of use, provide for settlements, and to prevent frivolous appeals. The loss of use can be broken into two definitions, and of course that's what the court administrator would decide. Is that loss of use the what it would cost to borrow the money, or what interest rate you could have gotten on the money? So that one issue alone becomes two separate issues. The intent of the interest awarded was to make sure that there was no benefit to the tortfeasor for stalling or delaying a payment. That was the intent. Then what they did is when they increased the rate, and probably rightfully so, they kind of made a punitive thing about it, that going, okay, you guys have been stalling. Not only are you going to make the victim whole, but it's going to actually be a deterrent to you. My suspicion, and I don't know this, is that what that did is that encouraged some settlements of lawsuits that had to factor in the fact that they were going to have to pay 10% interest as this went on. As far as promoting settlement, that's where that would fall into play, is that higher interest rate doesn't factor into what the actual indemnity was on the lawsuit of where they're trying to make the plaintiff whole. And as far as the frivolous appeals, that's just a matter of what this bill says, is that this bill still ensures that there is no benefit to the at-fault party, to the tortfeasor, for not coming to the table and settle. But it does get rid of that punitive element of it, that we're going to punish it, that the interest rate doesn't have anything to do with reality. Thank you.
Just a statement then, or was that a question? No,
let's call it a statement.
Okay. All right, very good. Any other member? Oh, Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question to the author. Representative Zerwas, would you... So, I took some notes here while you were speaking. You mentioned, market conditions, bringing this back into reality. So my first question for you is this a borrowing rate or a savings rate? We've heard some testimony to this. Which one is it?
Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, in statute, it's connected to the Treasury rate.
Okay.
Representative Carlson.
And what we're seeing here is we're borrowing other people's money before this gets paid. And just a quick search to look at the best credit card rates, personal loan rates, are way well above 10%. So by that 10%, actually, in reality, in terms of market conditions, is actually a really good deal. I mean, if you wanted to bring it truly into conformance with a true borrowing rate, we would be increasing that beyond 10%, not lowering it even further.
Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, 34 states, 25 within the last 30 years would disagree with Representative Carlson, and in fact, state statute disagrees with Representative Carlson, as it is not attached to a borrowing rate at all. It's attached to the treasury rate.
Representative Carlson?
It just reminds me, I believe, at, thank you, Madam Chair, at an earlier committee meeting, I heard that Minnesota was to be a leader, not a follower. So I guess I would stop with those remarks.
Thank you. Any other member questions? All right, seeing none.
Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To Representative Zerwas, do you have any specific examples in Minnesota where the current conditions where businesses come in and said this was a big problem that needs to be resolved?
Yeah, I think my testifier can give some examples where this has been a concern for businesses around Minnesota.
And Madam Chair, and I'm not sure concerned about generics. I want a specific example of where this has created a problem over the last 6 years, I guess.
Mr. Johnson?
This is a Kodak moment here, so. It's usually not on my right. Madam Chair, I don't have in my file here today actual cases to present to you. The point of the matter is, I mean, I've got there are clearly cases. You've heard the statistics on the amount of verdicts and in the system. So I haven't come here today with horror stories. I've come here to support a bill that's dealing with an out-of-reality number. And so in subsequent to this, I can follow up with you, or Madam Chair and Representative, to identify specific cases. But the point of the matter is, it's wrong in the system what we're doing with that 10% number. It is not a credit card number. If this legislature wanted the public policy to be credit cards, then you'd write it into the index what the court administrator is supposed to calculate. You have written in the one-year T-bill rate. That's what you wrote as the public policy. So for me, this discussion about credit cards and usury and mortgage rates, fine, we all get that. We know what that is, but that's not what the law is. So if somebody can advocate they want a different index, then I would guess that could go in for a bill for an act, and you could write a different index and have the court administrator deal with that. But, Madam Chair, could I make a comment to Representative Hillstrom's question, because it wasn't answered? And if I could, Representative Johnson, it's not your question, but if I could address just for a second, because it'd be good, and I should have in my original comments, is address the question about, in the bill, the last paragraph, E, and this change not applying to 60A.0811. I actually was at the table, and the recipient of the result of that law, and it would be in my employer's interest to drop that. But that's not what this statute is. Let's be clear on what this breach of insurance policy and the 10% number that you were asking about. That's a specific targeted penalty. It's a specific targeted penalty for insurance companies, liability insurance companies, who have breached their duty under the liability policy, and that's exactly what that is targeted as, a much, much, much narrower, and that is a totally different interest than issue than the judgment interest rate law. So it's an apple and an orange. And that the final results in the statute, if you go back to the year this was passed, which I was here in 2009 when this was passed, and Representative Atkins was the chief author of this legislation, this bill had a whole lot more. It started out at 18% for the targeted penalty. And ultimately, it was negotiated, and this is the language that Representative Atkins passed, that we worked out. So it's a targeted penalty for conduct of an insurer that breaches the contract, and that's what it is. It's totally different. So it's an apple and orange, and to suggest that this should be treated the same as the judgment interest rate law is just mixing two issues that don't mix.
Representative Johnson, were you finished with your questions?
I'll let Representative Hillstrom respond to this, and then.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. The way I see it, in both of those cases, somebody was wronged. A business was wronged in one statute, and the insurance company was found to be the wrongdoer. And in this case, someone else was wronged, and now the interest is paid to the wrong, to the person who was wronged. And so it's the penalty is the same. If you're the one who is wronged, the amount of money you get should be the same. That's the way I see it.
Mr. Johnson, did you have any response to that?
Well, I mean, that, Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I respect, obviously, your opinion and your read on that. My read on it is different than that, and that one is the broad system, interest rate, time value of money. The time value of money, that is what the prejudgment interest rate law is. This other one is for a breach, and you're equating that breach with a tortfeasor, or Representative Lesch's comment. That's somebody who's made a mistake. We all know what negligence is, and any of us can be a bad player if we've breached that duty of care. If we run a red light, we're a bad player, I guess. No, we made a mistake, and tortfeasors are going to have to account for their mistakes if they've caused damages, and we're all good with that. That's what the system should be. But I differentiate Representative Hills from those two.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair and members, maybe surprising, when I was here in 2009 too, and they both changed to 10% at the same time. And as this was negotiated, and you look at 60A.0811, you'll notice that it doesn't say a consumer insurance policy, and it didn't need to, because the interest rate that was changed at that same time in that same session was changed to 10% as it related to judgments that consumers were entitled to. I just want to just make one other point. Representative Lesch asked about prejudgment interest, and that'll take a long time to explain, and we won't need to do that. But what he said, what Representative Zerwas said, I want you to think about this. He said nobody's getting 10% return on their money right now. And I agree. But you can't get a return on zero. I have zero money right now. The person who caused the harm has money. I can't get any return. And that's what the interest rate is intended to do. And prejudgment interest in Minnesota, you have to make a motion for it. You don't just get it. And if I have interest on my credit card that I can show as damage, I get that. So the prejudgment is an issue, but it's not the main issue. It's what happens after. And Representative Zerwas said he wants to leave it at 10% for post-judgment. So what is it that we're really trying to accomplish here? Because if I get my prejudgment interest that's stated in my contract as a damage, and we want to leave it at 10% for post-judgment, what is it that we're really trying to accomplish here? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Johnson, do you have one other question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I'm just bothered or frustrated by the fact that I'd like to see a specific example of where the current status of affairs is a problem. Otherwise, I'm not sure, you know, what the problem is you're trying to solve. I don't see any specifics. You're talking in abstractions, but if you can provide me some examples where some business or whatever is getting injured by the current state of affairs. Otherwise, it just seems to me like the little guy is getting kind of stuck with it, and I don't see how that's a plus.
Mr. Johnson, do you have a response?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, you heard the statistics on the verdicts. I'm not here characterizing this as a terrible result. This is the point is if somebody is negligent, there's an underlying award for their whatever the damages are, their special damages, their general damages. This is the dollar amount that's going to be on top of that. So we're not talking about not compensating somebody. We're if somebody's negligent and they're found negligent, those damages are there. This is what's that time value of money. And the point is that we have a statutory rate that's 10%, and that's not the market. And so we put a floor of 4%. That's four times the market. We're not arguing with the four. So I'm a little struggling with it. So that's what happens. And so whatever the number of cases that have been processed and gone to verdict and are subject to this, from our perspective, that's just not a good result because 10% is out of sync. So I'm not. It's not an emotional issue. It's not a characterization that this is going to sink the boat. It's just a wrong number, and that's recognized around the country. The states are truing up their law to fit the market. So I'm trying to be responsive. I'm not trying to evade that. But that's just the fact of the matter. I can go out and try to find verdicts, and the verdicts will show just what we're describing today. If there's a verdict and the prejudgment is applying, it's going to have 10% on it. If you've seen articles in the paper of cases where there's multi-million dollar verdicts, then those multi-million dollar verdicts would be subject to the 10% number. And there have been cases of multi-million dollar verdicts, but the multi-million dollars was for somebody who was found negligent. So whatever the behavior, was negligent behavior, there's medical cases that happens to, there's nursing home cases that happens to. So it's not an argument that somebody shouldn't be paying for the damages they cause. What's the time value of that money? And so we've got a law. We put it at a 10% rate. The government gets 4%, and we think the 10% is too high.
Representative Johnson.
Well, then just have someone from this group come and talk to me and give me an example of where current law has created a huge problem for them.
Yeah, I'm sure, Representative Johnson, I will do that.
Okay, thank you. Representative Lesh, final question, and then we'll go to Representative Zerwas to wrap things up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Johnson, I've been asked to make this question really brief, so I will. And I think it's a simple question. So we'll see if you can answer it without the standard poetry, which, by the way, your poetry is good. But I got to ask this. Now, this bill, you want to propose it because it's going to affect a change. So I want to know, is it going, people who are entitled to a judgment and are going to get paid, is this bill going to make it likely that they get paid sooner or later? One or the other.
Representative Johnson. Mr. Johnson.
Right. We have Representative Johnson here. So, Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, I want to be clear that I understand your question. So you said it's gone to verdict or they've been awarded a verdict. And so your question is that if somebody has been awarded a verdict, assume for personal injuries, let's say.
That's right.
And now we change the law, frankly, ultimately the way the chief author has indicated, which is not fully yet reflected in the bill.
Correct.
Then going to verdict, there's not going to be any change sooner or later because it's going to stay at 10%. So whatever the 10% post-judgment does today, it's going to continue to do in your case. Of how quickly they're going to be paid, there's not going to be any change in that.
So there's no need for the bill then. There's no change in Minnesota, right?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, I think there's half the bill. The part of the system that we're talking about is prejudgment interest, not post-judgment.
Representative Zerwas, final words.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members, as Mr. Johnson stated, this has to do with. Identifying and recognizing what state statute identifies. State statute identifies as the marker, as the true north, the one-year treasury bill, and sets the rate off of that. And it changed from 2009, it was changed to 10%. Government, small and large, came to the Capitol, according to Representative Lesh, with hordes of lobbyists and convinced the legislature that 10% is unreasonable. It's not correct, connected to reality. It's too expensive for government. The legislature agreed. It dropped it to an absolute floor of 4% with the potential of going higher for government only. What this bill is saying is let's treat all individuals the same. let's allow them that same floor. And so that's the bill, and I ask for your support.
Madam Chair, ask for the roll.
Roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Scott?
Yes.
Representative Lush?
Nope.
Representative Carlson?
Nope.
Representative Dean? Representative Hillstrom?
Nope.
Representative Howe?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Nope.
Representative Lunan?
Yes.
Representative Lucero?
Yes.
Representative O'Neill?
Yes.
Representative Pugh?
Yes.
Representative Vogel?
Yes.
Representative Whalen?
Yes.
One, two.
The vote is 8-4. The motion prevails. You're on your way to public safety. Thank you, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Representative Lesh. House File 1316. And the motion on this, Representative Lesh, if you'd like to move your bill, is that it be laid over for possible inclusion in a data practices omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I've got a presenter here who's going to present the bill. I've been approached by several groups representing a diverse set of backgrounds that have issues with potential implications. So, and I expect them hopefully to come up and testify to clarify what those concerns are, because it is my intent to meet with everyone after this and see if we can come to an agreement to sand off any edges that may be necessary with the bill, and try to get it smooth before it goes in an omnibus bill, Madam Chair. So just with that stated with clarity, I do hope that with that assurance, I still want folks to come forward and testify so we get on the record what the concerns are, and that way they can be more properly addressed.
Right. And I believe the A1 addressed one of those concerns ahead of time. Did you want to address that amendment, Representative Lesh?
I would have Mr. Gemberling address the
okay,
A1.
Very good. Mr. Gemberling, do you want to explain the A1 and what it does? First of all, introduce yourself with the tape, please.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. My name is Don Gemberling. I'm the spokesperson for an organization called the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information, which is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization full of citizens, a few lawyers, and some journalists, and librarians. Explain the amendment?
Yes, please.
Okay. In some discussions after the bill was introduced, we realized there were some possible problems, and hopefully the amendment takes care of that. As you can see, one of the things the original bill does, as does the amendment, is to avoid reviving all of the discussion about the usage of body camera footage, and that was a major role of the amendment. So.
Right. So what this does is it makes clear that what Representative Lesh is bringing us today doesn't affect the classification of that data.
That's, Madam Chair, that's correct.
Very good. Any other discussion by members on the A1? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Mr. Gemberling to House File 1316.
Madam Chair, members, one of the things the Coalition on Government Information does is it reviews things that happen in the world, including legal developments. And as you can see in the bill summary, there was a case cited last year in which the issue was, if you have a videotape of an incident on a Metropolitan Transit bus, and it's an interaction between a citizen and a bus driver, what's the status of that data if someone makes a request for it under the Data Practices Act? And that case was originally went to the Office of Administrative Hearings, which supported having that video made available to the public. It subsequently went to the Court of Appeals, which upheld the Office of Administrative Hearings, and it went to the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court said, no, those other people were wrong, okay? Now, one of the realities of the Data Practices Act, and you really have to be deep in the Data Practices Act to start understanding some of this stuff, is that how the statute actually uses verbs may have an effect on how the courts interpret the statute. And this is really a good example. When I read Justice Stress's opinion, I said, oh, I understand what he's saying, I may not like the result particularly, but I understand how we got there. Because in essence, what the case says is, once you have a videotape, which when it's generated by on a bus, you're going to have government data under the Data Practices Act. But what happens to that videotape under the case will determine whether or not it's available to the public. Because what the opinion says is that because that videotape was moved into the personnel file of the bus driver, that made it personnel data, and because it's that kind of video is not on the list of personnel data that's public, it's presumptively private, which is how the personnel data section of the Data Practices Act works. Now, interestingly enough, this case was accompanied by another case in which the citizen who interacted with the bus driver asked also to get a copy of that videotape because he was clearly a subject of the data on the tape also. And the Supreme Court held he gets access. And as a matter of fact, there was a story a couple of 3 days ago in the paper which essentially summarized what was seen on the video. And if you read the story, I think it really illustrates why we really have to make a decision about how these kinds of things are handled. Because when you read the interaction or the summary of the interaction of what happened on the videotape, you can see that from the citizen's perspective, what happened to him was not very good. I think he was either deaf or blind. I can't remember which.
Blind.
I think it was blind. But from the government's perspective, he was handled very respectably. Well, the way you sort those things out, at least to some extent, is being able to see the actual video of an event. So part of what my organization does is we sit down at the beginning of the session and say, what are some things we think the legislature ought to consider and clarify in the Data Practices Act primarily, but sometimes in other statutes. And our solution essentially is to say that with the exception of things like body camera footage, that most video that captures interactions between the public and public employees ought to be public. Part of my thinking, frankly, because I've spent so many years doing this and spent a lot of time wondering about government surveillance just as a public policy issue, is it always strikes me as very odd that all of us get surveilled by the government all of the time. You got cameras in here, but they're not
cameras.
Yeah, they're not. I can't remember where I was the other day, but there were two parabolics in a hallway, and it was like, you know, parabolics are the round ones that do 360. It was in a government building. I thought, okay, fine, that's a security thing, but. But on the other hand, although government likes to surveil all of us, it doesn't like when it's surveilled to have that information available to the public. And I've always found that curious. I understand it because I understand how government thinks sometimes. So the idea behind the bill, and thank you, Senator Lesch, for bringing it forward, is to clarify the status of this kind of data when it's held in the government.
Thank you. We're going to go to all testifiers, and then we'll come back to member questions. The next testifier, Mark Anfinson, with the Minnesota Newspapers Association.
Madam Chair, if I could, so I'm going to write down the names of everyone who's coming up to testify, but if I could ask the folks who fancy themselves stakeholders, if you could, check it with my assistant, Madeline Garces at 217. We're going to make a list to make sure that everyone's included in this.
Right. Mr. Anfinson, please state your name for the tape and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members Mark Anfinson, attorney for the newspaper, Minnesota Newspaper Association. I am also authorized to speak today for the Minnesota Broadcasters Association. Are we all supposed to call you Senator, by the way, here at this?
Yes.
Is that?
Actually, if I can come up with my own title, that'd be
okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, I'll be very brief. I mean, the Newspaper Association and Broadcaster Association support this bill, and that's not going to be a shock to anybody on the committee. It's a broadening of public access. But the more important thing it does is it leapfrogs the remarkable complexity imposed on an already very complicated law by the Supreme Court decision. I litigated that case to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court actually didn't reverse the Court of Appeals. It confirmed much of the Court of Appeals interpretation of the Data Practices Act in a good public access way. It just put an overlay on the decision that made the law much more complicated. KSDP-TV, which was the plaintiff in the case, got the video it requested. It only took 3 years. What's the big deal about that? So the bill, Representative Lesch's bill's best feature is it would reduce the complexity of the law. And that's not just good for public access and for the news media, although it is. It's good for government. Government has to manage this law. And it's become so, excuse the phrase, just god-awful complicated that much of, if I may offer my humble opinion, much of the focus of this committee going forward should be to try and simplify this law so it can be used by citizens and by government officials more conveniently. We do have a bit of a concern with the scope of the original bill. We don't think it would be a terrible thing to narrow the scope a bit. So instead of applying to every single recording made in any by any government agency of anything, for example, that would potentially capture something like government employee voicemails. We don't see the public accountability, public access issue there. So we think it could be legitimately narrowed maybe to focus on publicly accessible places, places accessible to the general public, which are recorded frequently, as Mr. Gemberling says now, by government cameras. That's where the public accountability equation is maybe strongest. So that's all I have to say. Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you, Mr. Amundson. Ben Feist with the ACLU, then Irene with the League of Minnesota Cities. Good morning. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ben Feist. I'm Legislative Director for the ACLU of Minnesota. I'm also here in support of the bill and won't repeat a lot of the statements been made by the previous testifiers. A side note I have to add, though, for Representative Lesch, that I actually have a tortoise named Tortfeasor. So I think I've one-upped your friend. So it happens when you have a couple in law school together buying a pet that's going to live 100 years. You have to give it a very clever name. So anyway, I appreciate all the Tortfeasor references today. Well, the ACLU supports this bill because it promotes government transparency and accountability. It simply clarifies the presumption that audio and video taken by the government of its own employees and interactions with the public should be public data under the Data Practices Act. Similar to the other testifiers, we do have concerns that after the KSDP case, the government may be able to shield otherwise public information from disclosure by simply considering it part of a personnel file. And we understand that the language may still need some work, and we are happy to work on that process, but again, we very much support what the bill is trying to achieve. So, thank you.
Thank you. Irene, is it Kao?
Cow.
I'm so sorry. And then Grace Kelleher is after that. Well, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Irene Gao, and I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. And I do want to start off by thanking Representative Lesch for his willingness to work with stakeholders on this. And he and I did have the chance to talk a little bit about this. And was mentioned earlier, you all are aware that when we're talking about the Data Practices Act, when we're talking about government data, that is presumed to be public. And that's important because we want to make sure that the public understands what government is doing. The reverse presumption happens with personnel data because we're working with government employees, and there are some other categories as well, but for the simplest argument right now, we'll talk about government employees. And it is a reverse presumption where everything is presumed private. The bill as it is drafted right now would really mess with that presumption because we're focused on form now instead of the content. In the personnel data statute, it does list things that are supposed to be public, and there are over 20 things that are specifically listed so that the public will know things like the name of an employee, the salary, job title, existence of a complaint, for example. And if it were listed, if the bill were changed instead to be something content-based so that it didn't sweep in more than right now, as Mr. Amundson had pointed out, potentially voicemail, or maybe cameras at a recreation center. That might not quite be going to the same thing. Or if it was very narrowly tailored to what we're trying to get at with the case with KSTP, then we can talk about the language at that time. But our general concern is that it's covering more, would make more public than is the problem right now.
Thank you.
Yep.
Grace Kelleher, then Valerie Dosland. Good morning. State your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chairman and members. My name is Grace Kelleher. I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association that represent every elected school board member from around the state. And as we looked at this as school districts, it became clear that a lot of the video we take of our employees in school during the day might be covered by this. Very clearly, children is all the students we touch are not public. But there are many interactions in a school district, and I just wanted to write down a few for you to consider. Field trips in the principal's office, parking lots, gyms, libraries, entrances and exits, athletic events, theater productions, in hallways, on the football stadium, in the track, playgrounds, and if student videos actually caught a teacher in it. So we really feel the scope of this is so wide, and the requirement to keep the information for 3 years and somehow sort through it would be very difficult for school districts. So we appreciate your consideration of that going forward.
Thank you very much. Valerie Dosland, and then Brian Rice. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Dosland. I represent the Minnesota Association of School Business Officials. They're the kind of number crunchers and accountants and bean counters in school districts. And I just want to echo Ms. Kelleher's concern about the very broad scope of this bill and what exactly it means. Just to give you a really specific example, since this bill is in relationship to a Metro Transit bus, you know, public schools are required to transport kids to and from school on a daily basis. And while many schools do have video recordings or video equipment in their school buses, they currently only keep that information for 30 days, and it automatically resets on a feedback loop. To be able to have to store and retain that information for a certain amount of period of time, I understand it's 3 years, requires require a lot of logistical things, and while school districts want to be accountable and want to meet the intent of various regulations, it would be very expensive. There's about 12,500 school buses in operation in Minnesota. That would be to just for the equipment to restore the information would be about $25 million. We are happy to work with Representative Lesch and hope that we can narrow the scope of the bill and while allow Senator Lesch so that Senator Lesch can
That's all right, we're on a roll.
Yeah. Anyways, we are happy to work with Senator Lesch and just hope that we can
This isn't being recorded.
Yes. Yeah. We are happy to work with Representative Lesch and hope that we can narrow the scope of the legislation. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Just for the record, Madam Chair, I tried being a senator once, and we didn't agree.
Oh.
It didn't work
okay,
out.
Very
so
good.
Thank you for, you know, giving me a paper cut and pouring some lemon juice in.
Yeah.
I would note, though, Madam Chair, that the discussion, while the next person comes down, come on and sit down, is that the issue with respect to storage, I think, is an important one, and it gets brought up every year, whether we're talking about license plate readers or police body cams or this stuff. And I think it's worthwhile it gets brought up every year because it's such a moving target that members don't have a good sense of what are we talking about for storage now, how much data is being collected and how much does it cost. And storage is decreasing year after year, but it may not be, the cost may not be decreasing as much as people recall it used to decrease. So hopefully it'll be a good update on where we're at, because this is obviously not, this is going to be an ongoing issue beyond just data storage for what we're talking about in this bill.
Great.
Thank you.
Mr. Rice, go ahead and state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Brian Rice. I'm an attorney in Minneapolis. I'm here today representing AFSCME Council 5. It's a union of over 43,000 state and local government workers. many of whom are correction officers. And I would like to say that when Representative Lesch ran for the Senate, I did support him, but but today I do not support this bill. Let me just say, you know, we're here, I would say, in large part because of the KSTP case that my friend and colleague, Mr. Anfinson, did a good job litigating. But I call it the committee's attention. Basically, the media got what they wanted. I mean, ultimately, the video was released. The court interpreted the law, and the justice who interpreted this law was Justice Strauss, who was one of 20 individuals that President Trump had on his list to consider to be a justice of the Supreme Court, of the United States Supreme Court. And I think he made the right decision in the context of the law as it is. The individual who was the subject of the data got the data. That's what the law is. The MTC did an investigation. Ultimately, it was the record was in available, and the data was out there. And I'd like to echo just a couple other things that said. Ms. Gao made a very important point. This section of the law that Representative Lesch, the bill, proposes to amend is 1343, subdivision 2, that talks about what is public when it comes to your public employees, where there's over 150,000 public employees in the state that are affected by this. And the list of things is pretty concrete, that people can get name, salary, pension amount, date of employment, job title, disciplinary action when it's finalized. But this is, when you go to page 2, line 11, and I would really urge all the members of the committee to read this, this is as sweeping a bill as you're ever going to see. So the current practice is to say, with respect to your public employee, it's not public unless it's one of these. Ms. Gao said there are 21 things. There's 8 subparagraphs, but there's several things in each of these paragraphs. And they've been well considered. They've been looked at. I mean, I've been looking at this law for close to 40 years now. The list has grown over time, but it's grown slowly. And so now on page 2, line 11, all of these things are public, video, audio, or other recordings of government employees. That's one thing. Independent contractors or volunteers for government are now subject. This is going to be public information. So if I volunteer and took my kid to, you know, ice skating or to the nature center and I'm on the video, this committee really wants volunteers covered? I mean, really? This committee and the legislature wrestled mightily just a year ago with the whole body camera issue. And we've got a separate exception written into the bill. I also represent police officers. I'm not here on behalf of them testifying, but I can tell you I'll be advising them that this is a bill that really needs to be looked at very carefully. And I think, again, my good colleague, Mr. Anfinson, pointed out, do you want all your voicemails public? People leave you a message, and a constituent leaves you a message, and those are recordings that are now accessible to the public, and the government's going to deal with that.
Remember, we're exempt.
Well, yeah, you should be. Can we get an exemption for the Ask Me members? We'll go along with the bill then. It's a sweeping piece of legislation, and I hear the effort to try to work with that. Well, I did talk to Representative Lesch, asking me, glad to be part of a constituent group to work with it. But this is, you know, I just have to say that this is quite an expansion, all in reaction to a case that Mr. Anfinson and his colleagues won. The information was out there. It's public. The rules of the road are made more clear by Justice Strauss' decision. And I think sometimes it's that you do have three branches of government, the legislature, the governor, and the courts. And it can be expensive, but the court has illuminated the law. Spelled out its considerations. I think they reached the right result. I think the public interest is being served, and at least Ask Me Council 5 would start from the position that this bill is not needed.
Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against the bill? I see someone coming.
Good
Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Tom Kelleher. I represent the Minnesota School Bus Operators Association. We are the independent contractors for school buses. As Ms. Dozlin said, there are about 12,500 school buses in the state. We have about half of those. About a third of those have cameras. The discussion today seems to revolve around, one, the court case, and two, government data. But if you read page 2, lines 2.1, 12, and 13, it includes independent contractors. I talked to one of our medium-sized school bus companies. He's got about 100 buses. They rewrite over their hard drive about every 5 to 10 days because it's expensive to put new hard drives in or disks. He thinks that it would be about $2,000-$3,000 a year to retain the disks or the hard drives from the school buses, and then he'd have to store them, date them, have somebody do that, which, you know, we can't even find school bus drivers, let alone another staff person to do that sort of stuff. And what we have mostly rural school bus members, contractors, I should say. So I don't want to repeat a lot of what Ms. Dozlin said, but we have the same concerns. You know, as independent contractors, we're just kind of barely making it as it is, and this would be an extra cost of, you know, like I said, a medium-sized company would be about $2,000 a year to do this. The smaller companies, a little less. The bigger companies, obviously, more. And then we'd have to have someone to do this activity. So there would be a cost to us. And I guess I would ask the committee, and I've done data practices, privacy issues over the years, and usually half the committee thinks one way and half the committee thinks another way, and then over the weekend everybody kind of changes their mind. it's a typical issue. As you know, there's a lot of data that's private and there's a lot of data that's public. And I guess I would ask that if the intent is it the intent of the committee to include school buses? And that's my testimony.
Thank you for your testimony here today. Anyone else wishing to testify? If not, we'll move to member questions. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so these questions are for Representative Lesh and the scope of the bill and what he intends to include and what he doesn't. So Representative Lesh, my reading of the bill would mean that public employees who work, for example, at a prison that are constantly taking video surveillance, if the public employee is on the video, then that video would become public. Is it your intention that inside the prisons would be included in the bill?
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hillstrom, those are valid concerns that I would expect could be ironed out in the discussion among all the stakeholders. The broad array of issues that could result from a broad application of that language are not lost on me. So my expectation is that we'll get those ironed out in the working group and have an opportunity to have this vetted against once we're done.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That then goes to also Minnesota's state hospital. Given that those are public employees and they're video recording for safety, I assume then that they would also be included under this proposal. And then who would be responsible for editing out the people who are protected under the Data Practices Act? So the public employee is no longer protected, but the patients who happen to be there are. So who would have the duty and responsibility to edit all of this video, because it's 100% public then after this bill would become law?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Hillstrom, this has been one of those ongoing issues where if we broaden the collection of data and yet increase the data classification, we thereby increase the editing costs of doing exactly what you propose, which in many cases are eclipsing the storage costs. So I don't know the answer to your question, but I can tell you it's going to be
subject of our discussion because it's potentially one of those situations where the loophole outsizes the rule in what we're trying to do. So I can't give you a definitive answer of who would be responsible because if the implications of the language that we have in creates a big job of all kinds of editing like that, well, I mean, that's going to be something we have to deal with. We can't do that.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then I want to get into, because this takes care of all units of government, therefore local units of government as well. So this bill would also include all of the things that happen inside the BCA. It's my understanding inside the jail and inside interview rooms, because we're taking care of body camera video, and we have different classifications for that. But all of the interview rooms mostly have cameras that are stationary. So if it isn't specifically part of an ongoing investigation at the moment, or you know, maybe if you have a confidential informant who comes in to do that, doesn't that video then automatically become public under this because there isn't a specific section of law? You know, later on, maybe it's protected, but at the moment, sometimes it's reported it isn't.
Representative Hillstrom, confidential informants are already protected by the Data Practices Act. I'll let Representative Lesh go
ahead. Well, yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Hillstrom. To the extent there is one of those areas that say isn't already covered, yes, that's something that we're going to want to talk about in the working group. And the other thing that I would point out is the questions, the valid questions that Representative Hillstrom is bringing up, I can guarantee you there are going to be other questions that we haven't thought of today, but that will come up later. And I would encourage folks, to the extent that those are that you think of those, please do bring them up, because the next time we come forward to you with what hopefully is a finished product, that's a bad time to bring them up. So I don't know if that answers your question, Representative Hillstrom, but we will deal with it among the stakeholders.
Thank you, Madam
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, Representative Lesh and I did discuss this, and he asked me to bring up my issues and my concerns, and so this is not unexpected for them, but just so you're aware. And then I have another question. Hennepin County, for example, runs the hospital, right? So doctors and nurses and those kinds of things, there's kind of a quasi-business entity, but it really is a governmental agency that runs that hospital. Is it your intention that those folks would be included under this as well, or are those outside the scope? And if they're outside the scope, it would be helpful if that was very clear.
Representative Lesh.
And thank you, and Madam Chair, and I can't tell you right now if it's my intent if they be in or outside the scope. My only intent right now is having all these questions raised in order that we can have a discussion that focuses on an intent. We know the problem that we're trying to address, and we're going to try to address that, but I can't give you an answer right now as to... I'm sure there are some scenarios where there could be some potential scenarios within that set, that data set you described, that probably should be public, but I can't tell you which ones they would be right now.
And then this is the last.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Lesh, we have a lot of conversations about people who are stalked or harassed in many of the areas of the law that we work in. And what is it that a public employee would need to do to protect their data in the event that they know that they have a stalker or someone who is specifically out to harm them? We have a number of government workers who have the ability to change their address on their driver's license for safety purposes. And what would this bill do to protect the people that we already know are subject to those kinds of issues? And I assume the court is included as well as a public employee.
Yes. And
Representative Lesh.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, so we do have the existing Safe at Home program, which allows you to mask your data in those instances. It may be worthwhile examining to the extent there are situations that fall outside the scope of that, and I don't know which ones could, but it's a worthwhile question we'll look at. Thank you.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just wanted to briefly address some of the comments regarding storage and some of the processes we've heard described, and I just wanted to remind the committee, Madam Chair, that when it comes to technology, there's always more than one way to do something. And while those concerns are definitely valid and it should be part of the conversation, what I hear described, an example of physically taking hard drives out, physically storing them, that's just it's a legacy way of doing things. And as time goes on here, storage has become a commodity. And terabytes upon terabytes are becoming, depending on where you store them and how you store them, it can be down to pennies. And it's again, just reminding the committee that don't allow the fear of the technology to undermine the ability to hold government accountable and to keep it transparent. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Lucero. Concluding thoughts. Mr. Gimberling.
Yeah, Madam Chair, if I could respond to some of the testimony.
Sure.
I was puzzled by the retention discussion because there's nothing in the bill that requires that videotapes be retained. Now, there's bills on their way to discuss retention issues, but this bill doesn't say anything about that. Okay. So if a government entity under the records management statute has already set forth a retention period for this stuff, that's what they follow. So the three-year thing was very puzzling to me. If you look at line 1.9 in the bill, which is existing language in the Data Prices Act, you'll find that volunteers and independent contractors are already covered by the personnel data section. Okay? So again, I was puzzled by what seemed to be a suggestion that suddenly we're including volunteers and independent contractors when actually they've been part of the Act for a long time. Student data is protected under both state and federal law. The video cameras and buses primarily capture kids. Some of them, depending upon what kind of camera it is, may capture the driver, but by and large, what's on those videos are data about students, which is private under state and federal law. Representative Hillstrom asked who'd have the job of separating this stuff. Well, in the Data Practices Act, the responsible authority has the job or has the ability to assign the job to somebody to actually do that if it's required. Most agencies would never get into that unless they actually got a request for the data, so it wouldn't be an ongoing thing. And lastly, I think there was a comment about whether or not court employees would be subject to this.
They're exempt from
that. And the answer is the courts aren't subject to the Data Practices Act. There's a specific exemption for that. Mm-hmm. And kind of as a summary, if you wonder how we get here to this kind of complexity that some people mentioned, the complexity of the personnel data section was negotiated several years ago by representatives of government, representatives of the public employee unions, and representatives of the media. Okay? That's, you know, they did the deal. So I always get kind of cranky about this complexity thing, because the people sitting in this room are the people, and I'm not talking about you folks, because this happened, I think, long before any of you were here looking around. That complexity was negotiated by the stakeholders. So that's where it's at. And if you have any more questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Representative Lash?
Well, I'd add, Madam Chair, as you can see, we've got some work to do, but I think it's achievable. So I would only ask that I've got down here MNCOGI, Minnesota Newspaper Association, ACLU, League of Minnesota Cities, Minnesota School Board Association, Minnesota Association of School Business Officials, or Bean Counters, I think, as Ms. Doslin called them. I prefer that name. I like this. I just like it. Ask Me Council 5 and Minnesota School Bus Operators. If there's anyone else who wants, you know, to be in this fun little group, please let me know sooner rather than later and tell my legislative assistant, Madeline Garces, so that, you know, we don't get off on the wrong foot. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lush, for bringing this. And if I can be helpful in any way on the discussions, let me know. With that, we will – Representative Lush renews his motion to lay over House File 1316 for possible inclusion in a future bill. With that, we are adjourned.